My name is Sharon, and I serve the village's education lead, and it's my pleasure to welcome back Catherine Schiffenecker from Winthrop Seminary and her discussion of Job. One little housekeeping, we have evaluations that I've put out on the fireside ring, so if you could kindly fill out one this week, that we would totally appreciate, and we will keep that, so thank you for that. You can just return them here or in the evaluation envelope that's on the east side of the dining room or the bulletin board.
Excuse me, are the sessions recorded still?
Yes,
they are. Okay, thank you.
If they're in fireside or creekside, not Shelby.
Thank you.
Thank you for asking.
Thanks. Thanks, Sharon. Can everyone hear me all right?
Yes.
All right. Well, good morning, and welcome back to our second day on the Book of Job. I titled it, feel free, yeah, come on across. Learning our place, humility and wonder in the Book of Job. So if you weren't here yesterday, or if you were just yesterday, we talked about I did some background in Job, and we talked about the first couple of chapters. I just wanted to say another word about that. Two things. First, a number of you asked about Ellen Davis. So I had used a couple of quotations from my friend and mentor and teacher, Ellen Davis, and you asked where those were from. I should have had them on the slides yesterday, but they were both from this book. It's called Getting Involved with God, Rediscovering the Old Testament. So Ellen Davis, I had her in seminary. She was my teacher at Yale Divinity School. Then she moved to Virginia Theological Seminary and finally to Duke. She's been at Duke for 15 or 20 years. I think, and I'm biased, of course, but I think she is the most interesting and faithful and creative biblical theologian alive today. I mean, I know a lot of you probably know Walter Brueggemann. She's right up there with Walter Brueggemann. She's really, really good. And the best preacher alive, I think. This book started as a collection of her sermons and her lectures, and she kind of lightly edited them. So some of them are shorter, some of them are longer, but the quotation that I ended with about silence is from a chapter in this book called... I'm blanking on the title, but it's a chapter on the Book of Job. Sufferer's Wisdom, I think, is what it's called. It's a longer essay from a lecture that she gave on Job, but it's, I think, the best short theological piece on Job that I know of. I'll be using that chapter on Thursday when we get to the epilogue. But I would just highly recommend this book. I use it in my Old Testament introduction class, and one of my students said, you know, I read the other stuff first, the theological stuff, and then I save this for dessert. It's not that it's not theological, but it's just much more, it's much more approachable than a lot of theology, per se. So you can use it as information about the Old Testament. You can also use it as just a devotional book. So, all right, enough of an advertisement, but I should have said that yesterday when I used the quotation. So yesterday we were talking about the introduction to Job, and I just want to say one thing more about that, and that is, I hope this was clear yesterday, I don't think of Job as a historical tale. I think of it as something more like a parable or like a thought experiment, right? Let's talk about the innocent suffering or about undeserved suffering. Let's think of the most righteous man we can think of. Well, we saw there's this folktale figure of Job, right? Okay, Job is righteous. He doesn't do anything to deserve his suffering, and yet he suffers. How does he suffer? Well, there's this wager between the Satan and God. And it goes kind of bam, 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 chapters 1 and 2. And then the heart of the book really is from chapter 3 onward to say, how then do we respond to suffering? What is a faithful response to suffering? So we can talk more about that in the question and answer time. That's my own take on it. Usually I tell my students, you know, it doesn't matter to me whether you think of something as historical or not historical. But I think in the case of Job, if you think of it as a historical tale, it really messes with your idea of God. As Virginia Woolf says, God doesn't come out of this well if you think of God as kind of playing with people's lives in this way. At the same time, if you want to read the first two chapters in a very generous way, you could say that God is risking something on Job. Right? The Satan says, does Job fear God for nothing? Does Job love God for nothing? Doesn't Job love God just because of what Job gets out of it? And God risks the possibility of human beings loving God for God's self. Right? God says, no, Job loves me, Job fears me, Job is in relationship with me because of who I am, not because of what Job gets out of it. And just that possibility of a human being who could love God for who God is something that seems so extraordinary, and yet God says, no, it's possible. And God is risking that possibility on Job. Right? If Job, of all people, can't love God for who God is, then nobody can. Do you get what I'm... And I realize that's a very generous reading of the book and kind of perhaps tries to let God off the hook a little bit. But it is a possible reading, and one that I just want to offer as a possibility. But we can talk more about that at the end of our time. Today, we're moving from those chapters 1 and 2 to chapters 3 through 37, and we're not going to treat all of them with equal weight. I want to spend a fair amount of time on chapter 3, and then a little bit of time on the friends, and then most of the time on Job. And the possibility of lament, and I'll talk a lot more about lament a little while later. We ended yesterday with the three friends coming and sitting with Job in silence for 7 days and seven nights, and we talked at the end about what does that silence lead to? That silence in itself is important for, especially for those who are grieving, that silence can be a place of healing, even though it's a really difficult space to be in. What arises out of Job's silence and the friend's silence and his wife's silence is chapter 3, where, and again, I'm using William Blake's illustrations here. In chapter 3, Job breaks the silence first. He's the first one who speaks. And Job curses the day of his birth. You can see in Blake's illustration, there's Job in the middle and his wife on one side and the three friends on the other side kind of acknowledging his grief. And the landscape behind him is really rather apocalyptic. It's dark, rocky places with smoke rising from them. So Job curses the day of his birth. Let the day perish wherein I was born. I used Charles Schultz yesterday. Today I'm going to use Dilbert. So when I read this particular cartoon of Dilbert's, I think of chapter 3 of Job. So Dilbert's walking with his mom. His mom says, "How is work, Dilbert?" "Well, Mom, I'm like a fly stuck in a thick tar of despair. Incompetence hangs in the air like the cold stench of death." This is my favorite line. "I'm drowning and monkeys dressed as lifeguards are throwing me anvils." "My job has convinced me that life is a stale joke with no punchline. I long for the comfort of the grave." His mom says, "Next time just say it's fine." "I enjoy our talks," Dilbert says. "It's fine." His mother kind of acting in the role of the friends there, but particularly the line of Dilbert's here, "I long for the comfort of the grave." This is straight from Job, chapter 3. There's a similar passage in Jeremiah, but in Job 3, if you have your Bible, go ahead and turn to that. So again, Job is right before the book of Psalms. So Psalms is usually pretty easy to find, and then Job is right before it. So Job chapter 3 begins, "After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. Job said, "Let the day perish in which I was born, and the night that said a man-child is conceived. Let that day be darkness. May God above not seek it or light shine on it. Let gloom and deep darkness claim it. Let clouds settle upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it." Job, well, really Old Testament people in general are really good at cursing and blessing, but here cursing. And so Job curses the day of his birth. It's kind of like It's a Wonderful Life, right? Where, what's the character's name? I've forgotten. George Bailey, thank you. George Bailey wishes not just that he was dead, but that he had never been born, right? This is Job's wish, not just that he was dead. He's not just suicidal. He wishes he had never been born, or that if he had been born, that he had been a stillborn child. It's not in It's a Wonderful Life, George Bailey gets that, you know, nice chubby Clarence, comforting Clarence, the angel, right? Job gets God in a cyclone. So it's not quite fair, but that's the way it is. It's not as clear in the English as it is in the Hebrew, but in Job chapter 3, Job is really relying on Genesis 1 or using the same language as Genesis 1. So you know Genesis 1, of course, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth and the 7 days of creation, right? What is the first thing that God creates? Do you remember? Let there be light, right? Sorry, I don't have the English translation up here, but that's in Genesis 1, 3. In Hebrew, Yahi Or, let there be light. Let there be light. It's the first commandment. In Job chapter 3, verse 4, Job says, Yahi Choshek, let there be darkness. This is not a common construction. And I know it seems nitpicky, but when a biblical writer uses a particular construction that is not very common, they are alluding to something before them. It's a very intertextual kind of way of writing and reading. And there's just hundreds, probably thousands of examples in both Old and New Testament of writers either quoting directly from previous scripture or referring back to it, alluding to it. And this is a case of allusion. So Job, God says, let there be light at the beginning of creation. And Job says, let there be darkness. That day, that is the day of his birth, let it be darkness. May God above not seek it or light shine on it. In cursing the day of his birth, Job not only curses that particular day, but at least potentially all of creation. Right? Remember in Genesis 1, God creates by setting boundaries, right? God creates a boundary between light and darkness and between the waters above the sky and the waters below the sky and between the dry land and the seas. And in Job chapter 3, Job tries to abolish those limits set in creation. So he tries to plunge the world back into that primordial night, choshek in Hebrew. There's other parallels between Genesis 1 and Job 3. Both of them begin with darkness. In Genesis, darkness was over the face of the deep. In Job, Job says, let there be darkness. Both of them end in rest. In Genesis 1, it's the rest of Sabbath, right? The seventh day, God rested and God hallowed that day and consecrated it. In Job 3, it's the rest not of Sabbath, but of death. So look just a little further in chapter 3 here. Let's say verse 3:11. Why did I not die at birth, come forth from the womb and expire? Why were there knees to receive me or breasts for me to suck? Now I would be lying down and quiet. I would be asleep, then I would be at rest with kings and counselors of the earth who rebuild ruins for themselves. He wants the rest not of Sabbath, but of the grave. He wants to, it's parallel and yet a kind of perversion of Genesis 1. I already said this, but Job abolishes the limits set in creation. He wants the stars to be dark. God creates the stars in Genesis 1 for times and seasons, and Job wants to extinguish the stars. And finally, the first commandment that God gives human beings when he creates them is, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. It's the only commandment we've really been good at keeping, right? In Job chapter, and that commandment, that blessing of procreation, that blessing of birth, of fecundity, is indeed a blessing. I had a professor at St. Olaf College who was very cynical, just very cynical man. But he had a small son, a baby boy. And he said in class one day, he said, the only unequivocally good thing in the world is a baby. He was, yeah. Which was good. I mean, at least that was good. But, yeah, and then the baby grew up, and I don't know how he felt after that. At age 2, I'm not sure how he felt. But I think it's a pretty worldwide phenomenon that birth is celebrated, right? It's a good thing. A baby is a good thing, most all the time. But in Job chapter 3, that command to be fruitful and multiply becomes negative. Birth, Job views birth and fecundity as a curse rather than a blessing. All right, so I spent a little time on that because tomorrow it's going to become important when we come tomorrow to the whirlwind speeches, when God does show up and speak to Job. And these images of birth and of light and of creation are reworked or reestablished in those whirlwind speeches. So I just wanted to highlight, not skip over chapter 3, because it's important when we get to the whirlwind speeches. Another thing to note, there's another not common Hebrew word called suk, which means to fence in. Job uses it in chapter 3. He says, why is light given to one who cannot see the way, whom God has fenced in? It's only used 3 times in Job. The first time is in the mouth of the Satan, where the Satan says, have you not put a fence around Job and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. So the Satan says, you've put a fence around him to protect him from all harm. And Job says, no, that fence has become like a noose that's, you know, keeping me in, so I can't move. We'll come back to that too tomorrow, because the word is used one more time by God this time, and it kind of calls both of these worldviews into question. we talked about chapters 1 and 2 yesterday. We talked a bit about chapter 3. Let's move into the rest of this dialogue, particularly chapters 3 through 27. As I said yesterday, there's 3 cycles. There's these 3 friends or companions. Eliphaz always speaks first, and then Bildad, and then Zophar. And Job responds to each of them in turn, and then the second cycle, the same pattern, and then the third cycle, the dialogue kind of breaks down, and Job has the last word. I want to talk just briefly about the friends, and then really move to Job for most of our time. So Blake has this great illustration of the dialogue of the friends. As we said yesterday, they come and they sit in silence with Job for 7 days and 7 nights. And that's a beautiful practice, right? It's great pastoral care. It's great friendship to just sit in silence with someone in such great grief. But then they open their mouths and everything goes to hell. So watch the hand gestures. So here's Blake's illustration of them coming to see Job initially. And then the next one is his illustration of the rest of the dialogue. You see that? It's just such a great kind of shorthand illustration of what they say, because what they say over and over and over and over again ad nauseum is, you're suffering, so you must have done something to deserve it. So just repent, and God will forgive you, and then everything will be all right again. And I love how Blake, you know, it's not just one finger pointing, but both fingers pointing at Job in accusation. And this is basically the whole gist of what the friends say. And they say it, well, I want to say one thing positive and one thing negative about the friends. On the positive side, you might say that at least they're there with him, right? At least they're sticking with him. They're trying to make sense of something that doesn't make sense, right? A man, a righteous man who's lost everything, including his health. They're trying to kind of rework their worldview to include that situation in their narrative and to help Job kind of inhabit a new narrative. But the way they go about it just is wrong. They don't take Job's situation into account. And I think they do it not so much out of sympathy for Job, but out of self-protection, right? So I think about a time, do you remember when Gabby Gifford was shot, right, in Phoenix? Representative, right? No, no, Senate, right. So she's shot, and in that same shooting, a child was shot and killed, right? And I'm not remembering the year exactly, but it was probably, what, like 2011, 2010, something like that. We were out and about, my family was out and about, and my daughter Esther, who you might have seen around here, a blonde, she's 14 now, but at that point she was 8 or 9. She was in the car and we had the news on, and I didn't think they were listening to the news, so, you know, we were listening to the account. And at that point they just said a child has been shot and killed, but they didn't say whether it was a boy or a girl. And Esther's, you know, a year or two younger than the child who was shot. And she pipes up from the back seat. She says, "Was it a boy or a girl that was shot?" And I said, I don't know. They haven't said." And Esther said, "Well, it must have been a boy." Do you understand the reasoning? Because if it's a boy, then I'm okay, right? If it's, like, children should not be shot and killed. That just doesn't make sense. But if it's a boy, then I'm still safe, right? Because I won't be shot. It's childlike reasoning, but it's the same kind of reasoning that the friends are using, right? If Job, of all the people in the world, the most righteous person in the world, can suffer like this, then what's to protect me, right? He must have done something wrong. He must have been in the wrong place at the wrong time, or she must have dressed inappropriately, or, you know, we still, it's a self-defensive mode, and we still do it, even when we don't mean to, right? So that's what the friends are doing. They're protecting themselves. Again, back to Charles Schultz. Lucy says, "You know why your doghouse burned down? Because you sinned, that's why. You're being punished for something you did wrong. That's the way these things always work." Snoopy says, "Blah, her kind deserves to be blad." So. Lucy is playing the part of the Job's friends here. So I want to show a brief video clip, a little comic relief, just to say it could be worse in Job's situation, or it could, maybe it couldn't be worse, but there are similar situations. So the clip is from a movie called A Serious Man. Are you guys familiar with that? So it's the Coen brothers, so it's dark humor, right? So let me just set it up a bit. It's just like a 4 or 5 minute clip. I'm going to choose the shorter one rather than the longer one that I was going to do. So the situation is there's this main character, Larry Gopnik. He's a Jewish man living in St. Louis Park, a suburb of Minneapolis, in the 1960s. And everything's gone wrong. He's kind of the Job figure. So his wife has asked him for a divorce. He's had to move out and lives at a motel called the Jolly Roger with his brother, who is depending on him financially, and his son is smokes dope, and his daughter doesn't care about him. And his wife wants a divorce because she's seeing someone else, another Jewish man. And so he goes to his synagogue to get counsel from his local rabbi, and he's hoping to see the senior rabbi, but he gets stuck with a junior rabbi. and so this is his consultation with the junior rabbi. Okay, just a little translation here. Goy means Gentile. You all know that. Hashem is God. In Hebrew, it just means the name. So Hashem is God. And a get is a divorce decree in Judaism. All right. That's Larry.
Which end is up? I'm not even sure how to react. I'm too confused.
What reasons did she give for the rupture?
She didn't give reasons, just that, things haven't been going well.
And is that true?
I guess, I don't know. She's usually right about these things. I was hoping that Rabbi Nachner could...
That he would yes?
Well, with the benefit of his life experience. No offense.
I am the junior rabbi. And it's true, the point of view of somebody who's older and perhaps had similar problems might be more valid. And you should see the senior rabbi as well, by all means, or even Marshak. If you can get in, he's quite busy, but maybe... Can I share something? I too have forgotten how to see him in the world, and when that happens, you think, well, if I can't see him, he isn't there. He's gone. But that's not the case. You just need to remember how to see him. Am I right? I mean, the parking lot here. Not much to see. But if you imagine yourself a visitor, somebody who isn't familiar with these autos and such, somebody still with the capacity for wonder, someone with a fresh perspective. That's what it is, Larry, because with the right perspective, you can see Hashem, you know, reaching into the world. He is in the world, not just in shul. It sounds to me like you're looking at the world, looking at your wife through tired eyes. It sounds like she's become a sort of thing, a problem, a thing.
She is seeing Cy Abelman. They're planning. That's why they want the get.
Oh, sorry.
It was his idea.
Well, they do need a get to remarry in the faith. But... of God's will, you don't have to seek it, of course.
The boss isn't always right, but he's always the boss.
That's right. Things aren't so bad. Look at the parking lot. Just look at that parking lot.
That's it. A serious man.
Yeah, it's called A Serious Man. It's hilarious in the Coen brothers' usual kind of dark way, but it's funny. So Larry ends up going to the second rabbi and then the third rabbi, and they're all like Job's friends. They're really of no use whatsoever. In fact, the third rabbi won't even see him, the very senior rabbi. But the second rabbi is particularly hilarious as well, but it's a little longer. But the things that the junior rabbi says, right, not just the parking lot, but these are expressions of God's will. You don't have to like them, but you have to accept them, is what he says, right? And Larry sums it up by saying, he's not always right, but he's always the boss, right? This is not Job's response. He doesn't think God is right, and he lets God know that. And that seems to be all right. That thing about, you know, he's not always right, but he's always the boss, is not really true to the biblical witness. Because in the biblical witness, so we talked about the friends conversation, we're going to leave them and move to Job and what he does. In the biblical witness, including especially in the book of Job and in the book of Psalms, a faithful response to suffering is not just the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away, blessed be the name of the Lord, right? That is one faithful response. But another equally faithful response, and one that is actually more prevalent in the Old Testament, is lament. Lament is a form of prayer that takes seriously God's promises and God's power. So in lament, the prayer, the one who prays, says, God, you are God, right? You can do something about this situation. And you promised to do something about this situation. And so now I'm calling on you to keep those promises. So the kind of image I have of lament, I use this image with my students, is at Luther Seminary. It's holding on to God with one hand and shaking your fist at God with the other. And both of those movements are crucial to lament. You're holding on to God. You're not letting go of God. You're not, like, the opposite of lament is not trust. The opposite of lament is saying, well, forget you, God. I'm done with you. I'm not going to talk to you anymore, and turning your back on God. In lament, you speak directly to God. You hold on to God. You hold God to God's promises. But you're also completely honest with God, you know, that's kind of shaking your fist. God knows how you're feeling anyway, so you might as well be honest. And God is big enough to take the questioning, the hurt, the grief, the sorrow, the anger, even the hate. That's the stuff of lament, to say, God, you are God, now do something about this. Really, lament is kind of the other side of the coin from praise. Because, well, for one thing, most laments in the Psalms end in praise. but also because in lament, you are praising in a way. You're saying, God, you are God. That's a form of praise. Now do something about this. I won't spend much time on this slide. It's more kind of seminary student stuff. But laments have various parts, usually. Sometimes I'm missing one or the other. But the really important parts are these. The address, the direct speaking to God. So not speaking about God in the third person, but speaking to God directly. You, my God, right? Why have you forsaken me? In Psalm 22, probably the most famous lament. O Lord, my God. And then the complaint, my enemies mock me. You know, my enemies surround me. You have abandoned me. The complaint is part of the heart of the lament. And then the movement to a petition or a request. Save me, God. Lift me up from the pit. Answer me, God. These are, you know, both the complaint and the request are a key part of the lament. There's usually some expression of trust in the lament. You have been my God. You have been my God since I was, laid on my mother's breast. Now come to me. Or you have been my people's God. You have saved my people. If you can't think of the situation in your own life where God has been faithful, then you also rely on the witness of your people through the centuries. And then there's usually a vow to praise. I will praise you in the great congregation. So many of these are part of not just Job's individual speeches, but the whole book of Job. We'll come back to some of those. John Levinson was my thesis advisor in my doctoral studies. He's an Orthodox Jew and biblical theologian. And I love how he characterizes lament. He's speaking specifically about Psalm 74 here, because of all the kinds of psalms there are, lament is the most common kind of psalm. Levinson says, Psalm 74 expresses a theology that honestly and courageously draws attention to the painful and yawning gap between the liturgical affirmation of God's absolute sovereignty and the empirical reality of evil triumphant and unchecked. So there's this gap between what we say about God, that God is all-powerful, and the reality on the ground of evil. The psalmist acknowledges the reality of militant, triumphant, and persistent evil, but he steadfastly and resolutely refuses to accept this reality as final and absolute. Instead, he challenges Yahweh to act like the hero of old, to conform to his magisterial nature. And this, I think, is a great one-sentence definition of lament. The psalmist calls upon God to close the gap between his reputation and his current behavior. To close the gap between his reputation and his current behavior. This is who you say you are, God. Now do it, right? Because it's not apparent on the ground, right? Barbara Brown Teller, another great preacher, speaks of Job's movement here. She says, Job turns from his friends, who in any case are more invested in defending God than they are in defending him. Job will deal with God, or he will deal with no one. If God will not answer him, then he will fill the air with his own furious poetry. This is how faith looks sometimes, a blunt refusal to stop speaking into the divine silence. So even when God is silent, when God is not, or at least is apparently silent, lament continues to speak, lament continues to pray, continues to hold God to God's promises. I asked my friend John Hermanson, Johnny, I don't know what you prefer going by now, John.
Both.
All right. To give us an example of lament, Johnny did a CD on the Psalms and set many of the Psalms to music, and so I'll hand it over to him.
This is Psalm 22. My God, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from the words of my misery? My God, I cry day and night, but you don't answer. Yet you trusted you, you delivered them to you. cried and were saved and were not put to shame.
So did you hear the lament, right? My God, why are you so far from me? And yet, that expression of trust, yet you have been my God from my mother's breast. And the petition, do not be far from me. Answer me, God, right? This is the power of lament, that it gives us permission to be honest with God and to bring all that we are and all that we feel, including anger, including questions, including doubt, to the throne of God and to be there, to lay it there, and to trust that God hears and that God will answer. Jews are a lot better at this than Christians are. I think we sometimes, Christians are, and particularly, I should say, you know, white, Scandinavian and Germanic Christians tend to be a little scared of this, right? Can we really say these things to God? But if you read Job, if you read many of the Psalms, they give us permission to say, yeah, this too is part of the life of faith, to wrestle with God, to struggle with God, to hold God to God's promises. So just a real gift, I think, of the book of Job, of the Old Testament in general. If you read these speeches of Job and his friends, and you felt like they were just repeating themselves, I think that's part of what you're supposed to think. They do seem to just talk past each other. I do have a whiteboard. Sorry. The friends, I think, kind of just circle around and around and around and around, and they never really move out of that. I think Job circles around a lot too, but there is some movement, I think, that is perceptible. So he keeps coming back to like his wish for death, but slowly but surely he comes, he starts moving out. And I just want to talk quickly about two of those movements. One is from wishing for death to wishing for justice. So in chapter 3, he says, you know, I wish I'd never been born. I wish I had the rest of the grave. I was in the grave and resting in the grave. He moves from that, and he comes back. He comes back to it. He wishes for death later on after chapter 3 as well. But more and more, he starts wishing instead for justice. And it's that anger and that desire to have God answer him in a court of law that moves him actually away from those suicidal tendencies to something else, to wanting God to answer. I'm not going to go over all these lines, but at the end, that wish for justice is full-blown, and he says at the very end, Oh, that I had one to hear me. Here is my signature. Let the Almighty answer me. Oh, that I had the indictment written by my adversary. Surely I would carry it on my shoulder. I would bind it on me like a crown. I would give him an account of all my steps. Like a prince, I would approach him. That's the end of chapter 31. I should have that up there. He doesn't wish for death so much. He wants God to answer him. But I think the more important movement actually is Job moves from speaking only about God to speaking directly to God. At first, he addresses his friends and God, but more and more, he addresses God directly. He makes God a partner in the dialogue and thereby sets up the direct address of God to him in the whirlwind speeches at the end. And at the end, he's speaking not so much to the friends, but to God. The key movement here, the key movement from speaking only about God in the third person to speaking to God in the second person occurs in chapter 7. I just want to look at a few passages and then we'll have time for a little bit of discussion. This is one of my favorite passages. It's very harsh, but it's very honest. Job speaks, moves from speaking to his friends to speaking to God. And he says, "Am I the sea or the dragon that you set a guard over me?" This refers to a myth where the sea is this kind of primordial chaos monster that has to be defeated in order for the world to be created. "When I say my bed will comfort me, my couch will ease my complaint, then you scare me with dreams and terrify me with visions so that I would choose strangling and death rather than this body. What are human beings that you make so much of them?" Does that sound familiar? What are human beings? Psalm 8, right? "When I see the stars, what are human beings that you care so much for them? And yet you have made them just a little lower than the angels." It's exactly the same Hebrew. Again, it seems that the author of Job is alluding back to Psalm 8. But in Psalm 8, it's a psalm of praise, right? "You've made us just a little lower than the angels." Job has an entirely different take on it. "What are human beings that you make so much of them, that you set your mind on them, visit them every morning, test them every moment? Will you not look away from me for a while? Let me alone until I swallow my spit." I love that line. And he goes on, "If I sin, what do I do to you, you watcher of humanity?" Right? This is not a typical Sunday morning prayer. I would guess that all of us have felt at least something like this at some point in our lives. Or if not this, something perhaps closer to Psalm 13. "How long, O Lord?" Right? "How long, O Lord?" Blake illustrates this with this. You see Job on the bed and the demons of hell reaching out to him. And God is above him, like suffocating him. "What have I done against you, you watcher of humanity?" Now again, this is harsh language, but it's honest and it's real and it's raw. Wendell Berry, my favorite poet, says, "The distinguishing characteristic of absolute despair is silence. There is a world of difference between the person who, believing that there is no use, says so to himself or to no one, and the person who says it aloud to someone else. A person who marks his trail into despair remembers hope, and thus has hope, even if only a little." The person who doesn't say, who's completely silent, is different from the person who says there's no hope, but at least says that to someone else. And especially if you're saying, the person you're saying that to is God Almighty, there seems to be a grain of hope there in lament, a grain of hope that God will hear, that God will respond. And indeed, in Job, even in the pit of despair, Job has these kind of inexplicable eruptions of something that looks like hope, even in the midst of despair. He says to God, "Your hands fashioned and made me, and now you turn and destroy me. Remember that you fashioned me like clay, and will you turn me to dust again? Did you not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese? You clothed me with skin and flesh and knit me together with bones and sinews. You have granted me life and steadfast love, and your care has preserved my spirit." Job, in the midst of despair and loss and grief, remembers how God has cared for him in the past. And it's that memory that gives him hope that God will continue to hear. Even if God is the one who he thinks is oppressing him now with some reason. This is a really interesting passage. He's speaking to his friends here. He says, will you speak falsely for God and speak deceitfully for him? Will you show partiality toward him? Will you plead the case for God? Will it be well with you when he searches you out, or can you deceive him as one person deceives another? He will surely rebuke you if in secret you show partiality. Job kind of forecasts the ending of the book where the friends think they're defending God, right? They think they're defending God's honor and God's integrity. But in the end, God chastises them and says, you did not speak about me rightly, as has my servant Job. Or you did not speak to me rightly, as has my servant Job. We'll come back to this. The last verse here. See, he will kill me. I have no hope, but I will defend my ways to his face. Or in the NIV, it can be translated either way. Though he slay me, yet will I hope in him. I will surely defend my ways to his face. This is lament, right? Though he slay me, or see, he will kill me, I have no hope. Yet will I hope in him. I realize that's pretty different, but and I don't have time to go into the Hebrew, but I will surely defend my ways to his face. Job accuses the same God, let me put that another way. Job holds on to the same God that he accuses. There's a tension in that, or a paradox in that, but it's the essence of lament, that Job clings to the God whom he's also shaking his fist at. Job clings to the God whom he also accuses because he can't do anything else. Because this is God. This is the God he has known his whole life. This is the same kind of honesty that we're called to, or that we're given permission for in our own prayers. I'm going to skip this slide for the sake of time to go to this last passage. Probably the most famous passage in Job is this, and it's one that is rightfully famous, because here, in the very pit of despair, at the bottom of despair, Job finds that the bottom of despair is solid, and he starts, and there's this eruption of hope here and faith. He says, oh, that my words were written down, oh, that they were inscribed in a book, oh, that with an iron pen and with lead they were engraved on a rock forever. For I know that my Redeemer lives, and that at the last he will stand upon the earth, and after my skin has been thus destroyed, then in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see on my side, and my eyes shall behold, and not another. I mean, yeah, you can't add to that. The great Easter hymn, right? I know that my Redeemer lives, or Handel's Messiah, I know that my Redeemer lives, is gorgeous and is beautiful, but is even more beautiful when you see the context of the original passage, right? Here's Job sitting on an ash heap, covered with sores, scratching himself with shards of pots. Three friends adding to his misery, putting salt in his wounds, basically. And yet, in the pit of despair, he can say this: I know that my Redeemer lives, and that at the last he will stand upon the earth. Then in my flesh I shall see God. There's this hope that arises, even not even in the midst of lament, but because of lament, because God has been faithful in the past, because Job clings to that God who has been faithful in the past. Job knows that God will answer, and that at the last he will see God. This is the power of lament, and I could say more, but we should have some time for conversation. So, responses, questions, comments. Yeah.
I don't think any of the Lutheran churches that I have been a part of have been able to utilize lament. I mean, I went through years where it was like, you know, I needed to cover up those feelings, and that time when I could finally shake my fist at God made a different depth of relationship. And wondering how we introduce it to our faith communities.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so how do we reintroduce lament? I think it's best modeled from the leaders, and that's not the only way. But I'm thinking about my own experience in the parish in Wisconsin. There was and this is a very, very small example, but there was a year where we had some really hard deaths. You know what I mean by that? I mean every death is. But this was, you know, a woman in her 40s who died of breast cancer. She had been battling it for years. And then a woman in her 50s who died of ovarian cancer very suddenly, unexpectedly. And they died, like, within a week of each other. And then there were some other deaths later in the summer. And we got around, and, you know, the church was packed for both of these funerals. They're beloved members of the community. We got to All Saints Day that fall, right? And I happened to be preaching that day, and I got up in the pulpit, and I just said, it's been a really hard year. And you could just feel this, yeah, it's been a really hard year. Now, that's a really mild example, right? But just giving people permission to say, yeah, this sucks, and this is really hard, and death sucks. To give people that permission, I think, is just really freeing. And to be, I would say, for those of you who are pastors or leaders in the congregation, to be able to say something like that before the crisis, too. Like, to preach a series on Job or a series on lament psalms, or just a series on the psalms in general, including lament, and say, this is in the Bible, right? It's okay. You can ask questions. You can demand answers. You can express anger towards God. I think that's just such a wonderful gift to a congregation. Yeah?
Marga Dawn has a really wonderful book, Being Well When We're Ill.
Uh-huh.
And she talks about preparing in that way, to talk about Job, for example, in the good times.
Yeah.
So that when the hard times come, that we have that. And she said it's the difference between experiencing the pain and knowing that God is there. The experience doesn't always let us know that God is there, but if we've done this preparation, then we can say, I know that my Redeemer lives.
Yeah.
Because we have that in place.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you. So Marva Dawn as a resource there. Yeah.
The lament's not a bartering, though, is it? It's not a... Can you go back to the slide where you gave, or you can do it later and I can look at it, where the
outline? Sure.
Because I think there could be a tendency to let lament become a bartering in our demented humanity to say, well, if you don't, then I'm not going to. Or,
yeah.
Damn
yeah.
you, God, I told you. And I just see how the lament can take us even further from God. Rather, it just becomes the fish shaking as opposed to the clinging in
yeah.
the fish shaking.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good point. I'll start by saying that the psalmists don't consider it beneath God to, or beneath themselves to barter. So there's a number of psalms where the psalmist says, is the dust able to praise you? Right? If I die, there's going to be one less voice to praise you, God. And it seems cheap and it seems, you know, like... We don't want that. It's not, I'll say, it's not the purest form of prayer, right? But it is biblical. The way you can think about it is even in that kind of prayer, even in that kind of bartering prayer, you're claiming, you're believing that God's life is inextricably bound up with your life. Or the other way around, your life is inextricably bound up with God's life. And that it should matter, that it does matter to God when there's one less voice to praise. I mean, that's kind of putting a positive spin on it. But I think one really radical thing that lament does is say that the God of the universe, the God who created the cosmos, cares about me and my pain. And that's a really radical claim when you think about it. And so even those moments where the psalmists say, okay, God, you better heal me, you better keep me out of the grave so that I can praise you, even that is a statement of that it matters, that I matter to God, that my life matters to God. And that's really a statement of faith, a radical statement of faith, even in that circumstance. So I realize we're out of time. Is there maybe one more comment that, or question or insight? All right. Oh, one more.
Just that last piece, I thought of Anne Frank.
Yeah.
And that movement to hope in the midst of all that she had experienced.
Yeah, yeah.
She said, I think I believe in the goodness of humanity or something.
Yeah, as she's hiding from the Nazis. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you all for coming.